I'm Marty Moscowen, and this is Radio Times in Review, our weekly show when we go back into our archives and highlight some of the best conversations from Radio Times past. We're bringing you a trio of interviews with musicians who've been guests on the show. We'll hear my interview with cellist Yo-Yo Ma, a new documentary about his collaborative work called The Music of Strangers. Yo-Yo Ma and the Silk Road Ensemble makes its Philadelphia debut next Friday. We'll also hear from South African multi-instrumentalist and composer Bakiti Khumalo, most noted for being Paul Simon's longtime bass player. But first, we'll listen to my conversation with jazz saxophonist and Philadelphia native Jimmy Heath. That's all coming up when Radio Times in Review continues after the news from NPR. This is Radio Times in Review. I'm Marty Moscowen. We begin today's show of music conversations with jazz saxophonist, composer, and big band leader Jimmy Heath. Little Bird, as he was often called, was the arranger of this song, Picture of Heath, from 1960. Jimmy Heath is a Philadelphia native who grew up during the city's jazz heyday. He joined me in 2010 to give us a glimpse into the early Philadelphia music scene and to tell us how he got started playing with the greats of the era. Let's listen. You grew up in Philadelphia in the 20s in the city. What was it like?
Well, I grew up, I was born in 26 now. Yeah. So I grew up in the 30s. I was a kid.
You're not that old, right?
Well, 4 years old. Yeah. But Philadelphia was a jazz capital. It was a place where they had many jazz clubs. And I'm sorry to say they don't have them now like they did when I was coming up, because they have a lot of talented musicians, some of whom have been studying with me, and they need to have some place to perform. Yeah.
Why do you think Philadelphia was such a great city for music and for jazz at that time? What do you think it was about the city?
I think the whole country and the world was more jazz-oriented during that time. And in fact, all the big cities had many clubs, and that was the music of that time. And people came out to hear it. They weren't so conscious of what somebody said in the media to tell you what was good and what. They would come out and listen for themselves, neighborhood people. And they found out they liked the music.
You have a quote here. You have a lot of quotes from other musicians. This one from Ray Bryant, a pianist who also grew up in Philadelphia. And he said, there's something about Philadelphia that made it unique. They used to say it was the water. The atmosphere was fertile at the time, and there was a rash of musicians who were actually making a livelihood. It was one of the places to be if you wanted to really develop. There were so many guys to listen to and learn from. Is that your memory as well?
Well, that's true. But the other thing, Marty, was that it was close to the mecca of jazz, which is New York. So all of the talented groups would come through here first, come to Philly. So we were privy to hear all the newest sounds that were coming out of New York. And we adopted some of those sounds. And Philadelphia was like we were second string from New York at that time.
And New York, where you live now. You also described seeing Duke Ellington. I think your mom took you to see him when you were about 6 years old.
Yeah, well, you know, my father and mother were musically inclined. We had music in the house. At that time, people, you know, usually had a piano if they could afford it, before the guitar age.
You don't look very happy when you say that.
Well, they, you know, electronics, they kind of drowned out the music and got it to a point where it's a lot like almost like noise.
But you grew up in a house full of music.
Well, yes, my father played the clarinet in the Quaker City Elks Band, and my mother sang in the church choir. And we had all the records of all the bands at that time. And there were a lot of great big bands before the small groups came along.
And it was your father, he bought you your first saxophone, is that right?
Correct. My father sent it to Wilmington, North Carolina. He was on hard times, and my grandfather and grandmother in Wilmington had a grocery store, and they serviced the black teachers because it was segregated, the schools. And so I would go there in the winter.
Go to school back, there?
Yeah, and go to school in Wilmington, North Carolina, which was very different from any state I know because the state of North Carolina high schools, the white high school went to the 12th grade and the black high school went to the 11th grade. And Coltrane and I finished in 1943. We were the same age. Mm-hmm. He was in High Point, North Carolina. I was in Wilmington. We both finished school in the 11th grade while the white, you know, algebra, geometry, that stuff is Greek. So when my father sent me the saxophone to Wilmington, I said, well, this is it.
And did you take to the saxophone right off?
Yes, I wanted to play the saxophone because we were offered an instrument of our choice in my family. And my sister played the piano until she met boys.
And then she forgot the piano,
then
right?
She forgot the piano. Then my brother Percy played the violin. And that wasn't too hip to play the violin in the ghetto and being named Percy, you know. But he managed. And when I had to tell you a story about that because Percy had a teacher, oddly enough, whose name was Professor Pugsley. Professor Pugsley he had one of the longest pencils I've ever seen. And every time I would watch him taking lessons, and he'd make a squeak or a long, wrong note, and Mr. Professor Pugsley would hit him right on his knuckle. Mm. He was trying to beat music into it. So when my father asked me, Jimmy, what you want to play? I said, not the violin.
But it was the sax. I mean, was it something about just the sound that you connected with this instrument?
Well, I had heard Johnny Hodges and Benny Carter, who were outstanding alto saxophonists at the time. And I started on the alto trying to be like them until Bird came along. And then I tried to change my style to Charlie Parker's more modern style.
But then you got your own style.
Well, it takes a while, but I think I did. But however, there's a little Charlie Parker and Johnny Hodges, I hope, in there because they were great artists. And there's only one, you know. Now people think it's a lot of people can play, but, you know, it's like sending the clones.
Not sending the clowns, right?
That's true. Because, you know, it's only 12 tones, Marty. And how much difference are you going to make? Except that every generation somebody comes up with something just a little different.
Now, you tell us about some of the places that you played around Philadelphia. And you played with some amazing jazz musicians. But what was it like to play in some of the clubs in Philly?
Well, people came to the clubs to listen to music that they hadn't heard on the radio so much because we've always been second class when it comes to being on the media. And it was always, live music is always exciting. It's not canned music like it takes 4 months to make an album and stuff. I may have probably made that record that you heard in one session.
Wow.
You know, if you have the skills and the talent, you can do that. But the way they manufacture music now, it's very different. And there was the Zanzibar on Columbia Avenue, which is owned by a couple of brothers, the Watts brothers. And there was the Downbeat on 11th Street and Market. And there was this 421 in West Philly. Hmm. There was the Club Harlem. There was the Postal Card on South Street. There were clubs all over the city, in any section of the city, where you could hear live jazz. And that was one of the things that was exciting about living in Philadelphia.
I noticed a number of the musicians in your book talk about your parents, your home, how open it was, where they could go and kind of rearrange all the furniture and practice, make music. Were your parents, they were receptive, open? I mean, obviously musicians themselves.
Yeah, they definitely were amenable to us practicing in the house. And they also would feed a lot of musicians who came in town. My mother would cook. And if you were playing like Train was playing at the Showboat, and he had gotten very famous, and on, he didn't want to go all the way to West Philly, where he was living at the time. And he said, well, I said, well, look, John, you can come down. Mama fix something to eat. And, you know, Train came down to the house after the break in the Saturday afternoon, and then they have a matinee. I mean, after the matinee, you have about an hour and 2 hours before the evening session. And Train, he came down to my house. And I said, he said, Jim, can I practice while I'm waiting for the food? And he still practiced all that time. Then he ate mm-hmm. and went back to the Showboat.
Now, when did you start composing, or is that something you've always done as a musician?
Well, I started probably in, I think my first recorded composition was CTA. Mm-hmm. So that was probably in the 50s.
And it came, I mean, it sounds like, though, you had a lot of music in your head.
Well, I've been working on it a long time. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the environment was so rich. You could hear music all the time, everything. You know, my father would, we would be playing Stravinsky or something in the house also. And, you know, you could learn from Western classical harmony
yeah.
a lot. You just put the African-American beat on the music. And it's the same 12 tones as they have in Bach and Beethoven.
Are you a Stravinsky fan?
Yeah, I like the Firebird Suite, yeah, and I like Rite of Spring. You know, and I've used some of the devices that he used, the diminished, the double diminished kind of sound.
It's good stuff.
Yeah.
What was the difference between touring in Europe and touring in the U.S. for you?
When you tour in Europe, you're really accepted as being something, a person, an artist. Instead of, he's a jazz musician, you know, so and so and so. But you're an artist, and you're treated as such. They respected this music that came from our country more than some of our people here. And same thing with Japan. And traveling around the world in South American tour, we went, when Jimmy Carter was president, I went for 3 weeks to South America, and I found that to be very, very interesting also. They have their music, but they did love American music.
Do you consider yourself one of the giants?
At 5'3".
I meant musical giants.
Well, I mean, it's been said. Some people say that about me. Yeah. I'm an humble person.
Yeah.
And the people I loved, John Coltrane was an humble person. Dizzy was an humble person. You know, I don't like this arrogance in people, you know, that they think they're better than everybody else. And it's not true. You run into the backwoods and somebody will come up and kick your butt on your instrument.
Mm. Are we talking about someone in particular here?
No. I mean, but, you know, there are people without a reputation that are giants in the music that you haven't heard of. You know, music is in the sky, and everybody can grab some, and a lot of people do.
We close out my 2010 interview with jazz saxophonist and big band leader Jimmy Heath by listening to Thinking of You by the Jimmy Heath Quintet. When we get back from the break, some music and conversation with South African multi-instrumentalist Bakiti Khumalo. Stay with us. Welcome back to Radio Times in Review. I'm Artie Moss-Cohen. We continue my conversations with musicians now with Bakiti Khumalo. We're listening to his composition, Makaya. Khumalo is most famous as Paul Simon's bass player, making his debut on Simon's Graceland album. But the South African polymath has a career in his own right, having released 7 albums. He joined me in 2014 to tell us about his life in South Africa, how he got involved with Paul Simon, and to perform for us in studio. Let's listen. I do want to go back to when you were in Soweto, South Africa, and this was, what, 30 years ago.
Yes.
Paul Simon comes to your country looking for a bass player.
Man, you know, Paul really, he saved my life because he came in on the right time where things were so bad that I just needed to get out. And I was very fortunate that he was looking for the musicians, and I was working as a mechanic, helping the mechanic. You know, just running around. He says, give me range 2, range 3, whatever the range is. And I'm just like running all day long. And then my boss says to me, we just got a call from people who knows Paul Simon. They told us that Paul Simon is in town and they're looking for you to come to the studio. Do you know who Paul Simon is? And I'm like, no. And
never
I just
heard of
keep saying, no, I don't know the guy. And then they just keep singing the songs and Simon and Garfunkel. And I said, no. But one song that stayed in my mind was The Mother and Child Reunion.
Oh, sure.
And I said, oh, Paul Simon from Jamaica. They said, no, he's not from Jamaica. He's just, you know, playing right. The reggae. So, and I went to the studio to meet Paul. But, I mean, I didn't know Paul. And then there was a bunch of people in the studio. And Paul was very kind. And we just hang out in the studio and say, just play some grooves, you know, all day long.
Well, and the reason, I guess, he got to you is that you had been a bass player. You were a bass player in South Africa at the time.
I've been a bass player since I was 7 years
exactly,
old.
Exactly, since you were a little boy.
Yes, but, you know, the reason why I picked up the job, because my mother, she was starting to get sick, and I wanted to help out, because really the music, I mean, I record to everybody, all the groups around, but you get like $5
to play
for the LP, you know, like 12 songs, and so there was not enough money, so I picked up that job until somebody gave Paul Simon one of the tracks that I played on, and Paul loved, and he's like, can you get me these people?
You know, I do want to play just an excerpt from Call Me Al. Of course, this goes back many, many decades to this album, mm. Graceland. But this is just a section between with the penny whistle player
yes.
and you. So just for our audience, you can re-listen to what this sounds like. Let's give it a listen. To say it's so wonderful to even just isolate your playing like that. Describe how you play, and you did bring your bass with you, and I wonder if you could just do a couple of riffs for us.
Yes.
Okay. Said you didn't really know who Paul Simon was. What kind of music did you listen to as a kid?
The township music, you know, because we have so many tribes of people. We have Zulus, Xhosa, Sotho, Tswana, Shangaan, Pedi. So that was the music that was. You couldn't find that music on radios because mm-hmm. The record companies they didn't want to record that music because of. You know, tonation and people, they use their own instruments that they made, so it didn't really sound good. So the record label, they would do that. But that's the kind of music I listened to. And then also there was later on, like Motown, American music.
Sure.
Yeah, you know, and also some British music that the radio station also played that a lot. But the township music, you just hear when... You go around every neighborhood, everybody's playing something, so that's...
Mm. You played with a band. I guess you were a teenager. You used to play around, right? Tour?
Yeah. Well, you know, when I was a teenager, I just really looked for music everywhere. Like, you know, people that have practicing in the garages. So I would ride my bike to every township and look for the music until I joined this one band that had 10 bass players. All the bass players, but they all had jobs. You know, so me, I didn't have school. I didn't have no job. So I kind of spent a lot of time while they're working. Wow. And then when they come back, they're mad and say to me, "You've been here all day. You know, get out. It's my time to play." But so I kind of got stuck with it. And then later on, I was, I think when I was about 14 years old, and I was discovered by the record company, Gallo Records.
So what do you think it is about you and the bass that, you know, you're so comfortable together?
Well, you know, it's the extension of my my body and my life, something that really saved my life, you know. It was just amazing as a kid just to think about the bass, because all my friends, they would play soccer and, you know, they would do all different things. But then I picked the bass and I said, you know what, this is what I want to do.
Hmm.
You know, since the age of 7. By the age of 14, I was recording. And 16, 17, I was touring and I was running away from home because, you know, I wanted to spend time with musicians and I wanted to learn, like I'm still doing today. That's mm-hmm. why I get involved in a lot of sessions, because I want to learn and grow up as a musician, you know, and play all type of music. I take chances, you know. I mean, I took chances playing with Herbie Hancock, with Randy Brecker, and I'm like, I have daughters to feed, so I got to do something here, you know, and also learning experience.
I don't know if you knew just sort of how that album just took fire. And I was telling you during the break, going to the concert when it came to Philadelphia, the Graceland concert, and actually having to go through protesters who were protesting the fact that he had gone to South Africa. And
and we didn't understand as musicians why this is happening. Because really, you know, musicians were struggling, and the only thing we were doing for the ANC politicians, we were invited to play some gigs for free so that they get people so they can talk about what's going on. But musicians were very struggling. So when Paul came, I mean, the first time he came to the studio and we record with him, and he bought us food, and he bought me a case for my fretless, because I didn't have a case for the bass, and I had greasy hands, and he's like, anything I can do for you? And he just took care of musicians, and, you know, so we really didn't understand why this was happening, you know. Right now, they have a movie about that, you know, under African Sky.
Yes, exactly.
But the guy explained that, you know, they didn't know that Paul Simon was a good man, but they thought it was somebody to take an advantage since there was so much problem. But Paul did more than just give us the music, but what he did, he helped for the Nelson Mandela's release, because Paul Simon put the people together when we did a concert in Zimbabwe in 1987. All South Africans and people from all over the world came to Zimbabwe to see the show. And, I mean, for the first time, black and white together, it was amazing. He was a big part of that.
How did you end up in Bethlehem?
You know, when you're family man, you do whatever it takes. Well, you know, we used to live in Long Island. We bought a house in Long Island in Stony Brook. We lived there for about, you know, 12, 13 years, and my kids got the start and everything. And but we used to drive to Lansdale every weekend or every, like, Thanksgiving or Christmas, because my wife's brother lives in Pennsylvania. So we used to drive there until my wife got tired of Long Island. She's like, look, I want to move to Pennsylvania. And also she's an artist, Robbie Kumalo. She's a singer and she's a storyteller, jazz singer. But she wanted to come to Pennsylvania also to get a grant so she can do what she's doing, you know, without any problem. So she left me in Long Island for 2 years, and I'm trying to sell the house. It was fine for, like, you know, a couple of weeks because he was quiet, and I'm like, oh, what a freedom. But then it got scary afterwards. But things were kind of bad. The economy was not good. But I just stayed there for 2 years. And then once the house was sold, then I moved here. It was not easy.
A good move, though, in the end?
Yes, it was not easy because, you know, I mean, I had so much connection in Long Island and I knew everything, Starbucks, and I like Starbucks. But when I come here, there was no Starbucks from where we live. You know, the only thing is Dunkin' Donut. And I said to my wife, what about my friends? She's like, well, you're going to make friends and you're going to find another coffee shop.
And did you?
Well, Dunkin' Donut, you know. I still like Dunkin' Donut. When I see Starbucks, I give Starbucks a hug. Oh, you know, I miss you.
So you're going to do something, and I was watching you and John Aaron set something up, but why don't you explain what you're going to do, and we'll give it a listen.
This is something I'm doing. I hope it works out. You know, it's the kalimba. I just loop the kalimba. Let's see what it sounds like.
And I don't think our audience totally. You just did that.
Yeah, I just wrote this.
Right, you looped this instrument on the table here.
Yes, the kalimba. Actually, we can start with the Infinity. It's a looper that Pictronix, the company Pictronix, they make the looper for me because, you know, when I do live shows, yeah. I like to show people what I can do in front of them. You know, so that's what I use the looper. And I loop the kalimba, and I can loop about maybe 10 recording stuff and never lose the quality of the recording. That's what's nice about this looper.
Yeah, and what were you singing about?
I'm just singing about, you know, stuff my mother taught me how to learn, how to click. You know, amakanda is the egg. Ikute is the rooster, you know, so I'm just making up the clicking words. Because it's all rhythmic too as well. So when I do this, that means I don't need a drummer or percussion player because I've got this going on.
And is that, what language is that?
This is Zulu.
Zulu.
Yeah, I remember my mother, she said before I learned the language, they used to fight a lot and argue a lot in the house, and it was a lot of clicking and it was very loud. And she says, you know, I used to cry because it was like, oh, scary.
All the clicking going back and forth.
Oh, yeah. Especially like if you're in the township and you go past by the area where everybody's drinking, I mean, all you hear is like, you know, the lot of clicking.
Now, when was the last time you were back in South Africa?
I was in South Africa 2009. I was invited to do a masterclass, and then I went back 2010 for the World Cup. I was playing with John Legend.
Oh, sure.
And Ray Parker Jr. and the great drummer Steve Jordan and Leon Pandavas, and then we played with Alicia Keys, Shakira, Angelique, and I got a chance to see my family, and then. This 2011, I went back because I just got a call that my sister was looking for me, and I said I could not believe this because I knew my mother told me that I had a sister, but I didn't know my sister. I grew up without my sister, so I got this call and I went back home and then I connect with my sister, and it was just painful. I have to go back. It was painful because she grew up without a mother and I grew up without a father. And my sister, she's older than me. She's like 2.5 years older than me. And when she was born, my father denied my sister because she looked a little bit different than, you know, than the rest of my father's family. So my father denied my sister, and then my mother took my sister to my father's family, which is another town. They live, you know, about 5 hours away. My mother called my father's family to say, hey, look, I want you guys to meet me at the train station. And then they did that, and then she just left the baby and said, no, I'll be back, and she never go back. And then my father went back to my mother. I don't know how it happened, and then I was born next. And then my father left me and went back to my sister. Never seen my father again. So now both of these parents are gone, and me and my sister were just connected about, like, you know, a few years, 2 years ago.
Oh, my goodness. Does she look like you?
I'll show you the pictures. She's like, I mean, we're like twins, but she has much lighter skin than mine, and her type of hair much different, but we look alike. And so my sister, she wants to know what happened to the parents, you know, why the mother. And I said, I have no idea because I don't know what happened. Yeah. And my mother, she could not explain. Every time she talks about my sister, she will cry. And I didn't understand. I was young. So, and then same thing with my sister. She's like, I spent time with dad, but, and he passed away. And he was always talking about you. But, you know, so it was really painful.
Not very painful.
But, you know, we are connected now.
That was my 2014 conversation with South African-born bass player, multi-instrumentalist and composer Bakiti Khumalo. We close out our conversation with his song Ntombe Dance from his 2000 record In Front of My Eyes. When we get back from the short break, we'll hear my recent conversation with renowned classical cellist Yo-Yo Ma. Stay with us. Welcome back to Radio Times in Review. I'm Marty Moscoane. Thanks again for joining us. This is Yo-Yo Ma's rendition of Bach's Cello Suite No. 1 Prelude, perhaps the most famous composition for the cello performed by the most famous cellist in the world. Ma has been performing professionally since childhood, and for the last 16 years, he's been leading the Silk Road Ensemble. That's a group of multinational musicians named for the historic trading route. A new documentary about the project makes its Philadelphia debut next Friday, and it's called The Music of Strangers, Yo-Yo Ma and the Silk Road Ensemble. He joined me earlier this month to discuss his life, the cross-border collaboration, and the cello. Let's take a listen. I have to say how much I enjoyed this documentary, capturing, I have to say, the passion of these musicians, the joy of playing. And, I mean, these are all cliches, of course, and just this sort of universal, almost essential thing called music.
Wow. Thank you. I'm glad you liked the film.
I did. Because
one of the things that I love about working with my friends who come from many different places around the world is that I feel like our ensemble is a microcosm of the world and of our communities. And so it kind of was an experiment to see whether people from different shapes, colors, and stripes and habits and cultures could actually find common ground through common values of respect, generosity, sharing, and to therefore be able to create something that is that has clarity of expression, so that we can speak at various times in many voices, but in one voice. And so this is what you hear, and this is what the film is about. And so this is a continuing exploration.
Well, you use the word friends, and it's clear at watching you play in this documentary how deep that friendship is. And I'm curious about what you have looked for over the years. It's almost 20 years now, for the musicians, for the artists who are part of this Silk Road project.
Well, I think it's just, I would say, two basic values: that people know something deeply, that they're virtuosic in their knowledge of something, and in this case, obviously, of a tradition of playing an instrument. And the second thing that is in some ways less talked about but not less valued is generosity. Hmm. The generosity of wanting to share and to what you know rather than keep as a secret. And then also the generosity of being able to trust and to be open.
So an audition was more about who the person is or was than how they played their instrument?
I would say it's what's funny is that there was no audition. There never was an audition. And The first time we got together was there was an open call for musicians who would actually want to come for 10 days at a summer festival, the Tanglewood in Western Massachusetts in the Berkshires, which is where the summer home of the Boston Symphony Orchestra. Yep. And the BSO was very generous with giving us the space to rehearse music written and by composers from like 16 countries, and musicians came from there. And then we had a call for sort of musicians from the area, from the New England, anywhere, in fact, in within the continental United States, to say, would you come and join us? And guess what? People who came were curious. They were generous. They were virtuosic. And these are, in fact, still the founding members of the ensemble.
Oh, that's terrific. I want to play another song from this CD, this companion CD to this documentary. I'm hoping I'm pronouncing this correctly. Ichichila?
Ichichila, yes.
A song called Ichichila from Sing Me Home. This is this new CD by our guest Yo-Yo Ma and the Silk Road Ensemble. And again, a companion to this new documentary called The Music of Strangers. That is just so beautiful. Help us understand this music a little bit more.
Well, let's put it this way. I think this is one of the musicians in this track is Bala Kuyate, who plays an instrument, believe it or not, called the balafone. Hmm. And the reason it's called the balafone, it's like a xylophone. He is the 10th generation musician from Mali who plays this instrument. And basically, his family invented it. And 10 generations is about 250 years.
Wow.
No, maybe even more.
Wow.
And so what's great is that this is what happens when you have people in academia, people who are artists, people who know deep traditions, and others who know different traditions come together and work. And here you have this beautiful piece. And guess what? Part of what we loved this music is also, you talked about indigo dyeing.
Yes.
You know, indigo was actually at one time more precious than gold in terms of weight, because it was the blue dye that people used for uniforms, for jeans. In fact, you know, the earliest jeans all had indigo, and indigo was such a treasured dye that people wanted to kind of, you know, be able to plant it, first in Louisiana unsuccessfully, and finally a teenager from South Carolina found a way to plant it, and it became the second most richest crop in South Carolina.
And what I love, and I think we hear that with the rhythm, is, and again, I'm looking in the liner notes here, is just the rhythm is the sound of the sticks, I guess, as the dye is being made.
Absolutely, and I think this is, you know, and you go to like Morocco today, and which is like near Mali, and you see the dyeing. Not factories, but they're open. You know, a lot of leather is in fact dyed in Morocco, and then there's a tribe that the Tuaregs, who are known as actually the blue people because their clothing is all blue. So in fact, this is something. It's a tradition that's very, very much alive, and here we actually get to hear it in a musical version. But if you probe a little bit, you get into all this amazing history that is, in fact, part of our history.
I read that I think it was your father tried you out on the violin, and you hated the instrument. Why do you think you took to the cello?
Well, you know, it's very interesting. A lot of people say, you know, what should I have my child play? And says, you know what? Let the child choose, because people actually have very distinct likes and dislikes. It's not about some people just love music, but other people might try an instrument, they don't like it, and then one day they see a trumpet and they say, that's my instrument. And that's, I think that kind of happened with me, except I wasn't so smart. See, my problem was I wanted something big, and I saw a double bass. I wanted to play the double bass because I thought that was the biggest instrument, but I couldn't at age 4, so we compromised on the cello.
Obviously,
so it took me longer time to actually get used to it.
And was it a kind of love at first sight for you, even as a 2 or 3 or 4 year old?
Well, you know, I don't really remember, but I think I probably had a certain facility for the instrument that allowed me to progress, you know, relatively quickly. And but you know, it's one thing to play an instrument well, but it's another thing to become a musician. And then it's another thing to you know, really love being a musician. And because I started so young, I it took me, would you believe, until I was 49 that I decided that it was okay to be a musician? Because I thought, because I had not decided to be a musician since I had always played and I loved music, so I felt I'd never made a decision. But it was when I realized that music actually is a great way to explore all the things I love, human nature, people, cultures, different traditions, and understanding one version of why. That's when I thought, great, music is the place for me to be.
I know you went to Harvard. Did you, you studied anthropology there, is that right?
Well, I hope you won't, you know, count that against me.
But, no, I actually counted for you.
Oh, okay. Thanks, because, you know, it's a little embarrassing for Harvard, that is, that I went there.
Oh, don't say that.
I loved anthropology partly because of my different backgrounds. You know, I was born in France, in Paris, and then we moved to New York when I was 7, and my parents are Chinese. So I think I grew up with a lot of different people saying different things that kind of contradicted one another. And so anthropology was the first academic subject that could actually make sense of all the different places I knew, because it's the study where you can actually look at what are the primary values in each culture. And by identifying what are the priorities, you actually the culture then becomes the society or the country that we know as it exists. So that was – it was a great moment of enlightenment for me to actually feel that this is – that this is an academic subject that I could actually not only take to but use all the time in exploring the rest of the world.
I've seen you perform several times, including just a month or so ago here in Philadelphia for the, with the Philadelphia Orchestra, and I was watching you very carefully, just wondering, when you're performing, are you thinking? Or what are you thinking? Or are you thinking?
Well, that's a very, very good question, because that's a question I ask not only myself but people who play for me. Like, you know, I say they play something, I say, what's on your mind? Right. And what happens is if they say, well, I was thinking about this difficult passage, I'll tell them, guess what? This is what you're projecting. You're projecting that this is a very difficult passage that you're about to play. So, in fact, you want to be, you know, athletes, jazz musicians, we all talk about being in the zone, being in the pocket. You know, mm-hmm. So you're, what does that mean? It means like you are totally present for the content. So, you know, people talk about listening to a piece of music is, oh, you took us on a journey, you know, for films, you are, I was transported. What does that mean? It means that your imagination is fully engaged in the creation of a present that is superimposed on top of the present reality that everybody is experiencing right now. So that requires the public's imagination to go with you someplace. It requires unbelievable concentration to actually artificially create a world which you can define as, you know, representing the composer's voice. And you heard John Williams' Cello Concerto.
I did.
Which is this gorgeous piece of music, which the conductor, Stéphane Deneuve, and I talked every night about how we can make that piece sound even more expressive, how can be more organic. And I think we actually improved it every night until we got to the point where we thought John would be pleased with the concerto, because it's a very personal statement from him to have written that concerto. And so we think we found it, but we're going to actually check with him to say, you know, what do you think? And this summer, he and I are actually going to go over the score and to talk about it. So that's part of the process of what happens when you're performing something. You're trying to get it to another place that becomes, that's artificial, but then it becomes real. So people actually feel it, like it, and connect to it, and then make it part of their own lives.
This is Yo-Yo Ma and the Silk Road Ensemble's song O'Neill's Cavalry March from their new album. The documentary about the group called The Music of Strangers comes to Philadelphia next Friday. And that wraps up this week's edition of Radio Times in Review. Radio Times is produced by Debbie Builder, Emily Bryant, Liz Fiedler, and John Ahrens, who edits the show. I'm Marty Moscowane. Thanks for joining us. Have a great weekend.